Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Does everyone have the sheets? There are some by the food over there, by the water. Welcome to week 2 out of 3 on this in this business ethics series. Last week we talked about liability for bad advice and malpractice issues and giving professional advice. Next week we talk about borrowing without permission. This week we talk about, as you see on your sheets, contractual capacity of a minor. Frankly, when I first came up with the classes for this series, I'm not sure exactly what I was thinking when I picked this topic, in the sense that the other two sort of have a certain attraction to them. Malpractice issues and borrowing without permission is something that comes up for people quite a bit. A minor's ability to acquire property, doesn't have, I think, the same drama to it as the other two. So that when I sat down to actually prepare the shiur, I said, I wonder what I was thinking. But then I actually prepared the shiur and found a lot in here that I really enjoyed and that I think, I hope you'll enjoy as well. I want to look at three issues within this, and I should mention again, as I did last week, once again, thank you to Zeifman's for sponsoring the lunch for today, and to Steve Roth in particular for making it possible. So the three issues that I want to look at are, number one, why a minor lacks the capability of executing a contract within Jewish law. Number two, at what age a child is empowered to give to others or to sell to others, again, within Jewish law. And then third, at what age is a child empowered to acquire something for himself or herself? I'm not going to go with the pronoun, the him or her, the whole way through. The laws are the same for males and females. The only difference will be in terms of the age of maturity, which in halacha is 13 for a male and 12 for a female, and we're going to come back to that point a little bit. But other than that, when I say when a child can or when an adult can execute a contract, it's the same male or female. There is no distinction. We begin with the question of why a minor is not able to engage in a contract. And that's not just a Jewish question, that's a general question. Why is it that we have any distinction at all where we say you have to achieve a certain age before you can get involved in a business deal, sell property, acquire property? What would you say, it's a given, I think, in society. Why is there a distinction? Yes, Dory.
The other party does not take advantage of the minor.
Right. Right. So one argument is sort of, it's called the instrumental approach, is to say, because as a matter of practicality, it's a bad idea to have 5-year-olds make business deals with 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, whatever it is, because they tend not to understand what is going on. They may not understand the permanence of a transaction. They think that they can sell it to you and then get it back the next day. They may not understand the value of something. They're attracted by shiny coins. There's a concern for misunderstanding. So that's one reason. Yeah?
What about a contract between the same age group?
So then the question would be, what if you do a 4-year-old and a 4-year-old? And the answer I would give is that you still have concerns. Number one, because children mature at different paces, and that's number one. And number two, the fact that they're both going to misunderstand and make a bad deal isn't a good thing either. Right? I mean, when you send your kids to school and you pack them a lunch and you say, don't trade this with another kid, right? There's a reason for that. Well, there are multiple reasons for that. But the point is that you don't necessarily want two disadvantaged people, two challenged people making a contract with each other either. That's one argument. There's a second argument, though. But beyond that. Beyond the practical. There's a question of whether a minor is a person. And I say that deliberately in the baldest way possible. But does a minor have the right to engage in a transaction? Maybe you need to be a certain age in order to count as a person, so to speak. Take a look on your sheets, please. It's source number one. Article from a fellow by the name of Nathan Oman, Unity and Pluralism in Contract Law from the Michigan Law Review. He writes, contract theory suffers from an embarrassment of riches. Roughly speaking, there are two main camps, one of which contains two significant subcamps. On one side sit the economic theories, which not surprisingly argue that contract law should be guided by notions of efficiency and welfare maximization. You want to create contracts in a way that will maximize the good of all people, and that's sort of the practical basis for allowing contracts at all. Or let me take a step back and explain that what he's really saying is we first need to understand why contracts work in any way, shape, or form. Why does society recognize a contract made between two parties? And the answer is because you want to be able to benefit people. And then the second, on the other side, sit what Stephen Smith labels rights-based theories, which I brought you source 2 to expand on. Charles Fried, Contract as Promise. The regime of contract law, which respects the dispositions individuals make of their rights, carries to its natural conclusion the liberal premise that individuals have rights. And the will theory of contract, which sees contractual obligations as essentially self-imposed, is a fair implication of liberal individualism. What's suggested here, and I had a chance to read this 500 times to understand it, so I'm at an advantage in parsing what he's saying. But what Fried is suggesting is that contract law essentially says individuals have the right to do what they want with their money, to do what they want with their property, and society recognizes it not because it will improve society if people can make contracts, but because it's your property, therefore you can enter into whatever contract you wish as an individual. That's the second theory. So you have, on the one hand, an instrumental approach, utilitarian approach, that says contract is a means of achieving a goal, we want to empower people to enter into agreements, or you have a rights-based theory that says human beings should have their word recognized as individuals. Based on the different theories, you will have different disqualifications for minors. Under the utilitarian approach, we'll say it's because he's going to make a bad decision and so we have to protect him. Under the rights-based approach, though, the statement that we'll make is that the child is not yet a full human being. We'll say that the child is not a full person yet to justify having rights. And that's an argument that's made in the literature. And we certainly find both of these when you get to Jewish literature. We have both concerns. Rav Elchanan Wasserman summed it up beautifully. Rav Elchanan Wasserman was one of the leading authorities in Jewish law, as well as in general, one of the greatest rabbis in Europe pre-war. He was murdered in the Holocaust. And take a look at source number 3. In which he sums up the two reasons to disqualify a minor from the Torah's own sources. He says, "Beis dinim yeshnan bekatan." There are two issues regarding a minor. One, katan shlo higia lechlal das harei hu shote. He says, if a minor has not achieved capacity yet, if a minor has not achieved the ability to evaluate a potential transaction and decide good, bad, or otherwise, then that minor is just like someone who's mentally incompetent. And just like I wouldn't recognize the transaction of someone who's incompetent because I want to protect them, so too I don't recognize the contract of a minor. That's one explanation. That's the utilitarian approach. But then he says, katan pikeach, what if you have a particularly bright minor? Shanu Rowan Shayeshla Das Kigadol. We see he has the mind of an adult. Right? We know that there are children who are precocious and who are able to grasp adult concepts even in their minority. Umikamakom ein maase katan klum. Nonetheless, his actions will not be recognized. Vu gizera sakasuv. He says it's, as I translated here, by scriptural fiat. It's simply a dictate of the Torah's text. Where? Midichsiv ish velo katan. When the Torah says, it's in Parshas Mishpatim, it talks about the laws of gifts. It says, ki yitain ish el re'ehu. Literally, when a man gives to his peer. And the Rishalmi that he's quoting here says that what this means is, when a man gives, not distinguishing man-woman, but distinguishing adult-child. When an adult gives, not when a child gives. She'in koach b'maseh katan l'f'ol chalos kinyan o kiddushin. No matter how bright the kid is, a minor does not have the ability to affect a transaction. That's the second approach. Are we clear on the two different pieces of it? One is because the kid's going to get taken advantage of. The other is because in the eyes of Jewish law, a child is a child and not an adult and does not have the right to engage in such transactions. That's the first point. not a particularly practical point. It's more about theory. But I found the theory of this very interesting. The idea that you have these two different aspects of it. Okay. So at what age can this child give or sell to others? Well, is anybody familiar with Ontario law on this? At what age is a child able to give something away, to sell something, such that it will be binding? Because that's really the key.
16, I would imagine.
Nope. 18 is the age of majority according to Ontario's Age of Majority and Accountability Act, which is well named.
The age in a marriage contract without parental consent past the age of 16?
No.
18. 16 parental consent.
Okay.
Except in Newfie, actually, where you have to be 14.
Okay, I'm not getting into Newfie things. I'm an American, and it's bad for me to get involved in that. So, 18 is indeed the age. There are additional standards, something called donative capacity, determining ability to understand the gift, contractual capacity, ability to understand the contract. I actually brought that here in source number 4 for those who wish to look at it. Donative capacity is the ability to understand not just the nature of the gift, but to understand that it's irrevocable, you're not getting it back, and so on. Contractual capacity as well, ability to understand the business being transacted. There is an exception to the rule of 18, though. Right? What's the exception? It's an important exception to know. Nope. Basic needs. In the event that a child needs to have some necessity of life, and obviously that's a term that needs to be defined, but if the child needs some basic necessity, the child is able to execute a contract in order to acquire that necessity, and it will not be voidable. The child will not be able to retract having made that contract. So, for example, you have a case where someone is, I don't know, 15, 16, 17 years old, and they ran away from home, and they now need, or they don't have parents, whatever the case is, they need a place to live, and they want to rent a place to live. The law says that they're able to enter into a rental contract, and it would not be voidable. They can't back out. For other things, if they want to buy a chocolate bar, technically they can't. However, for necessities of life, they are able to do so. Why would we draw that distinction?
Practical purposes.
Which are?
Survival.
So, but now we're making it harder for him, because now he can't back out of such an arrangement.
Yeah, but he can enter into what?
Well, he can enter whatever he wants. In other words, a child who's under the age of 18 can enter into any contract he chooses. The difference is he can back out of the others. He can't back out of this.
The normal rent to him if he can back out.
Exactly. Because no one is going to rent to him if they feel like he can walk away. So what we're doing is we are binding him, we are restricting him. We're saying once you've entered into the rental agreement, you can't back out, but it's for his own good. Because otherwise, no one's going to do business with him. He won't be able to rent an apartment. That's the idea. That also is seen within halacha, although some of the applications change. Halacha also recognizes an absolute standard of age and capacity. Right? Age, as we've already said, is 12 for a female, 13 for a male. Capacity, we're going to come back to in a little bit. However, rabbinically, the sages said that that various transactions of a minor will be binding, and the child will not be able to void the transaction for the child's own benefit. Take a look, please, on your sheet at source number 5. Passage from the Talmud. Begins with a Mishnah, the earliest part of the Talmud. 3rd century was when it was canonized. And it says, Hapeutos mekhan mekach umemkaran memkar bimetaltalin. The Mishnah says, Peutot. What are Peutot? We have to explain that in a moment. But it's a child of a certain age. So a child of this age that we call Peutot is able to engage in purchase and sale of movable items, and it will be binding. Not of land, but of movable items. We're going to get to the land point in a little bit. But but in general, the child is able to purchase, is able to sell movable items. So the Talmud then continues and asks, Ve'ad kama, how young? What is the age of Pe'utot? When does that begin? I think also we now have the people here who are going to be here, so I'm going to pass around the sign-in sheet to make sure that I'm able to follow up afterwards by email on questions and to send out the sheets for next week. If you already put down your email address last week, you do not need to re-enter it this week. Just you write in your name and that'll be fine. Thanks. What is the age for pe'udot? So, in source number 5, Mechavi Rav Yehuda l'Rav Yitzchak Berei, Rav Yehuda pointed to his son Rav Yitzchak and said, Kivar Shis, Kivar Shev. 6 or 7 years old. Unclear, was his son a child at the time and he's pointing to him, say, like that age, or was there some other purpose in pointing to him? That's not clear from the context. However, he says 6 or 7 years old. Once a child is 6 or 7, their sales are valid. Their purchases are valid, and their sales are valid. And when we say valid, we mean they can't retract anymore. That's what we mean by valid. Rav Kahana Amar Kivar Shev Kivar Tamni. Rav Kahana says 7 or 8 years old. B'masnisa Tana in a Braita, a source contemporary to the Mishnah, but not canonized with it. But again, it's an ancient source. Kivar Teisha Kivar Eser, 9 or 10. And then the Talmud concludes, below Pligi, there is no disagreement between these sources. It depends on the kid. Each child, based on how sharp the child is. If the child is a really adept child, then maybe 6 or 7. If the child is maybe not so adept, 9 or 10. Why do we empower the child to engage in these transactions? The Talmud continues, Rabbi Abba Bar Yaakov, Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Abba Bar Yaakov said, quoting Rabbi Yochanan, the reason is, Mishum Kedei Chayav, for the sake of his life. The meaning, because again, otherwise people won't engage in business with him. So therefore, we are willing to recognize his transactions. That's the passage in the Talmud. If you take a look at source number 6, classic commentary to this section in the Code of Jewish Law that deals with business law, this is a work called the Sefer Me'irat Einayim. The reason why we recognize the contract is the imlo came, because otherwise, if it weren't so, ein shum adam ye yelo shum esek imo, nobody would have anything to do with him. Share yachol lachzer bo kashiyirtzeh, because he could recant at will. You thought you engaged in a business deal, and in fact, you didn't. Gam krovav yacholim lebatal masav. Not only could he back out, but his relatives could back out on his behalf. And you're out of luck. So we don't want that situation. Therefore,
the onus is on him to determine whether it's 6 or 7 or 7 or 8, depending on his own.
You are correct. So Sheldon points out a key point within this. Who's going to arbitrate whether the child was adept enough or not at the time of this transaction? In the end, if this comes to litigation, a Beit Din. It's going to come before a court, and the court's going to have to determine, based on people who knew the child at that time, presumably, this child did understand or this child did not understand. So if you're going to engage in business with someone of that age, you have to do the best you can to validate what's going on at the time to protect yourself against a future problem. That's true. In fact, the Rambam Maimonides in source number 7 rules that katan ad sheish shanim ein haknayaso la'acherim klum, until the age of 6, his assignment of property to others is nothing. Umisheish shanim ad sheyagdil, but from 6 until maturity, im yodeya betiv maso umatan mekcho mekach umemkar umemkar, if he comprehends commerce, his purchases and sales are binding. Okay, so what we've seen is that in order for the child to do well, in order for the child to have business partners, we're willing to recognize it from the age that the child shows essentially capacity, shows understanding, could be as young as 6 years old. There's something to be said about the difference between the 6 to 10 category, the 10 to 13 category, but it's a nuance I don't want to go into right now. Yeah. Yes, it appears to be the same, whether selling or purchasing.
He doesn't say.
Well, he does, right? He says, whoops. Haknayato, that's in terms of, right, the haknaya that he mentions here is what I translated as assigning property to others, such as where he sells something, that's true. But the opposite of it, which he hasn't mentioned, is his kinyan, when he wants to acquire something in terms of taking possession. So, hold on. I'm going to get to it when we talk about his ability to get a gift. So there, I'll make the distinction, I think, in a better way. But there are limitations to this rule. Meaning, what we've said here is, for his sake, we're going to recognize the purchases and sales, or specifically the child's ability to give or sell to another. That's only where it is for the child's benefit, what we call in the Hebrew, kedei chayav, for his life. So, for example, the Talmud discusses, casing to vote, dachayin, that it won't work if the child has a guardian. Someone asked the question about an orphan before. If there is a guardian for the child, this doesn't hold true. We don't recognize the child's transactions because they don't need this to survive. The guardian is supposed to be taking care of things. The guardians tended to be court-appointed. And if there's a problem, if the guardian is not doing the job, then you go back to the Beit Din.
Talking about Yosemite, not the prophets.
Yes. Exactly. Guardian is called an apotropos. That's correct. Another exception to the rule is brought by the Ramah, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, in the Shulchan Aruch. He says, if the child does something that's inappropriate, what if the child does something that the child wasn't supposed to do? Right? Let's say the child sold somebody and took a greater profit than is legal. There are guidelines for the maximum profit one is allowed to take on certain transactions. What if the child exceeded the appropriate profit? Or what about in a case of inheritance where the child was a male and the child sold off some of the property that was really supposed to go to the sister? The laws of inheritance say that depending on the level of assets that are present, potentially all the assets can go to the daughters, leaving the sons to go make their own way. What if one of the sons is a minor and he sold off his sister's property? So in such a case, the child's transaction is void. Because what we're doing is supposed to make things better for him by having his legitimate transactions recognized. We don't now also want to recognize a transaction that we shouldn't have recognized. Also, we mentioned before, he can only sell movable items, not land. And the reason for that is because, as it's generally understood, land requires greater acuity. You need a much better sense of the market and of what the land can be used for and so on. And it's felt that that's beyond what you're going to be able to reasonably expect from a minor. You're talking about greater realms of comprehension that the kid just doesn't have the life experience for, aside from the sophistication. So what emerges from this is that we have a comparison on the one hand, a contrast on the other, between what the secular legal system does and what the halachic legal system does. Both systems recognize that there's a need for children, for minors, to be able to engage in transactions. Right? That we had on both sides. But the system of law in Ontario said, we recognize specifically those transactions that are for basic necessities of life. Whereas, in halacha, we're being much more expansive. We're allowing much more, the child can do much more. We're going to see that now in a couple of interesting points. Number one, take a look at source number 8, please. Source number 8 is another example of a situation in which halacha recognizes a transaction that should not be valid, but it does so because of a person's unique circumstances. This is not dealing with a minor, this is now dealing with an adult. And what they're talking about is the issue that's called, in Hebrew, davar shalo bala olam. What is a davar shalo bala olam? Anyone know? Well, not just not in his possession, but doesn't exist. Oh, it can be something not in his possession. Actually, that's the case we're going to see, so let me not say that. Something that he doesn't have yet. The general rule is you can't sell something you don't own. There are exceptions to the rule. So I can sell futures, essentially. Let's say I'm a farmer. I am able to contract with somebody now that he's going to pay me X amount for the produce that doesn't, that hasn't emerged from the ground yet. There are ways in which it can be done. But the general rule is you can't sell something that you don't have. Keep that in mind and take a look at source number 8. Masha'irash me'abba hayom. What if you have a case in which someone says he wants to sell that which he is going to inherit from his father today? Now, if he's going to inherit it today, what does that mean is happening? His father is dying. Right, that's what we're talking about. And the Talmudic case is talking about a child who needs the funds to be able to bury his father. That's what we're talking about. So Talmud says if someone tries to engage in that transaction, technically it shouldn't work because it's not his yet. On the other hand, we're not going to make him wait until his father passes away and now start engaging in business. So therefore, he says, it's valid, mishum kavod aviv, to enable his father's honor. This way, the father will be able to be buried properly. Second case, mashatale mitzudasi hayom. You have a fisherman, and the fisherman needs money. So the fisherman says to someone, I have a prospective buyer. Whatever comes into my trap today, I would like to sell you. We have no idea what's going to land in the trap today, but someone's willing to make the deal with him. So we say that's valid. Why? Mishum kedei chayav, for the sake of his life. Because we can't afford a situation in which he goes out, does his day of fishing, and then doesn't find a buyer. So if he has a buyer now, we'll let him do this. That's another example of a transaction which shouldn't be valid, but rabbinically we say we'll accept it. Parenthetically, it comes up in this week's parsha. What's the transaction in the beginning of this week's Torah portion? Right? The Bechorah, the birthright. Right? Yaakov buys from Esav something that doesn't yet exist.
Well, it existed for Esav.
It doesn't exist for anybody. A birthright doesn't exist yet. The birthright only happens when Yitzchak dies. The idea of this double portion. The right exists, right. So the question is there such a thing as purchasing a right to it? Take a look in the Or HaChaim. It's either the Or HaChaim or the Kli Yakar at the beginning of this week's parsha, and he discusses the question about how is that valid? Is it under this principle of Mishum Kidei Chayav for the sake of his life?
The remember, the Bechorim were the ones that offer Karbonis. They want something to it, even while the Yitzchak was alive.
And you think at that point the Bechorim is bringing the Karbon? At that point?
The Bechorim was the one... They were supplanted by the
Kohanim. Right, but I don't know if that exists at that point. They're only after they leave Egypt.
Well, they followed everything from
Matzah. Right, the question is whether you'd follow that. There are reasons to suggest that in itself wouldn't. Abraham is not a Bechor. Abraham builds his bath and brings a carpet.
I know.
Esau thinks it has no
bag. Also true. So, but that's going back to the point is that here's a type of transaction which is valid because we want someone to be able to survive. If you take a look at the next source number 9, you see another example of it. The law in general in Jewish law is that if I think someone owes me something, then I am responsible to swear to the truth of my claim, in the event that I believe that somebody owes me something. Well, no, I need to give a particular case. Let's take a case of I need a good example. In the case of a loan, okay? Let's say there is a loan. I say that I lent somebody $1,000, and he claims that he paid me back $500. Right? That's his claim. So at that point, motive and mitzvah. Who has to swear? The borrower. The borrower is the one who is responsible to swear, because by admitting that the loan existed and by admitting that he only paid back half, he's going to have to swear that he actually has paid back half. Because we're concerned about what else he might be thinking and games he might be playing. But that's normally the way things work. So if you have a case in which an employee is working for an employer who acknowledges that the employee is working for him, and the employee says, I haven't been paid yet, really, the employer should be the one to swear, yes, I paid you. But it's not the law. The law is that the employee is the one who swears. Why is that? Source number 9. Sachir, amayta kinu le'rabbanan le'mishtaba v'shakil. Why did the sages rule that an employee may swear that he hasn't been paid, and then he can collect? So Rav Nachman says, quoting Shmuel, he says, takanos kivuos shanukan. We have learned fixed enactments, fixed decrees here. What he means by fixed decrees, Rashi explains in source number 10, decrees that will be appropriate to be made fixed, even uprooting the Torah for them. What do you mean? Shavua de balabayis hi. V'agruha rabbanon l'shavua de balabayis v'shadyuha asachir. Because really the oath belongs to the employer. The boss really should be swearing. However, we transfer it to the employee. Why? Mishum kidei chayav de sachir, for the sake of his life. Because what's going to happen otherwise?
The employer would swear and he wouldn't get anything.
Right, the employer is simply going to swear that I paid you already. The employer may not even know. He has however many employees. He's not paying close attention. The employee is going to be out his salary. So we said, let him swear that he hasn't been paid, and then he'll be able to collect the payment. Yeah.
In today's business world, where you have a paper trail of pay
pay stubs and bank account statements, etc., etc.,
right,
would not, would Shibori be affected? Because you, can't you say that this paper trail which exists there in the form of a shtar?
If you have a paper trail, you're better off than an oath. The oath is a last resort,
okay,
where I'm stuck. If I have a paper trail, that's far better. Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Is there a general principle that the person that wants to extract the money is the one that's responsible for the initial? That's okay.
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. Like the case I gave of the loan. Right? So it's often true. But it's not always true. The point of bringing sources 8 and 9 is to show that we do have elsewhere, besides the minor, this idea of, I want to help someone survive, and therefore I'm going to recognize a transaction that normally I should not recognize. However, we're broader when we deal with the minor than we are in these other areas. So, for example, the case of the fisherman who wants to sell off whatever he gets today, he can do that with today's profits. He can't say, I want to sell a week's worth, whatever I get this week. That will not be recognized within halacha. We're very narrow with what he can do. When you deal with the minor, though, we are much more broad. If you take a look at source number 11, Gam b'matana tiknu shetehei kayemes. Also with his gift, if a minor gives away property, we also say that it's binding. Because the assumption is, if he's giving someone a gift, it's because that person made him happy. And that person did something for him. And that's why he's now giving the gift. In the event that you don't allow minors to give gifts, you decrease the incentive for people to help them. We're assuming we live in the real world, not in the ideologically pure world in which people want to help children because they should want to help children. We're assuming that there's a major incentive for people to give to others in the event that they think that the other is going to give something back to them. And therefore, the minor is allowed to give gifts, to reciprocate, in order to ensure that others will give to him. I could have been very narrow and said, no, only sales are valid. But we're willing to recognize his gifts as well. David?
It seems to me that from the minors I've known at these ages, it's not unusual that they give disproportionate gifts.
Well, that's a risk, right? That's a risk of licensing this. It's true. You're 100% right. That is a risk that we have in this sort of a circumstance. I'm sorry?
It could be very easy to exploit for the person receiving the gift.
Yep.
I took you to the park, you gave me a car.
Yeah. No, it's true. 100% true. Take a look at source number 12. Talking about a case in which the minor sells more than he needs for the sake of his life. In other words, we're talking about doing this in order to afford the minor the opportunity to be able to survive. He enters some mega deal that is not what he needs in order to survive. Technically, I should say, that doesn't fit. Nonetheless, we accept it. That's valid as well. We are very broad. So that here we see an analogy between the secular law and the Jewish law in terms of saying we need to do something for the sake of the minor, but in halacha we're willing to go much further in terms of what we are going to do for the sake of the minor. We license the minor to do much more. That was the second piece. And then the third piece. At what age does a child acquire something that someone gives to him? How does it work in modern secular law? At what age, if you give something to a kid, at what age does it become the child's such that you can't back out afterwards? No? No. Oh, boy. The answer is any age. Any child, regardless of age, is able to acquire an item given to the child. There is no restriction. Yeah?
Look, you can't give it the first day. Can I give it to the child because he doesn't want to return it?
That's true.
Because it would be like, he wouldn't understand that it was given as a gift rather than as a, you know.
Right. What you're talking about is correct. That in general, because the mitzvah of lulav on the first day is that it's supposed to be your lulav,
right,
if you give it to the kid, it's not just the kid won't understand, the kid is not capable of giving
right.
it back.
Right.
So that's the concern, right. But in terms of this issue of something given to a child, in secular law, any child can acquire a gift. Here's something, though, that I found particularly interesting in source number 13. Roman law. from the same time as the Talmudic law that we're looking at. The following persons are incapacitated from all juristic acts. The infants, which I'm probably mispronouncing, or child who has not yet completed its seventh year. In other words, in Roman law, a child under the age of seven has no ability to perform a legally binding act. That includes receiving a gift. Then he says, the following persons are incapacitated from some juristic acts, but are capable of others. The impubes, or child who has completed its seventh, but not yet completed, if a boy his 14th, if a girl her 12th year. I found that really interesting. They have the same distinction of girls reaching maturity before boys, but they push the boy another year later. In other words, for them, it's 12 for girls, 14 for boys, whereas we had 12 for girls and 13 for boys. So that was a little interesting piece. Apparently not. He's giving you years. The legal position of persons of the second class, meaning a child between the age of 7 and 12/14, is as follows. They are capable of such juristic acts as result in an improvement of their proprietary position, but they are incapable of juristic acts which operate to alienate property or impose a liability. Someone turn that into English. What can a child do and what can't a child do between the age of 7 and maturity?
Buy or sell? No.
Well,
they're
going to
impose a liability. You're buying something, owing money, and selling is the giving away.
The child is able to acquire things. However, the child is not required then to pay for them, which means that, of course, the transaction may be reversed. If the child wants to back out, he's going to have to give back whatever it was that he got. He can't simply walk away and say, I'm getting to keep this. But in terms of gifts, the child will acquire a gift from the age of 7. So, modern secular law, a child can acquire a gift at any age. Roman law, a child can acquire a gift at the age of 7. We clear? Okay, what happens for us is subject to how we understand two conflicting sources. Number one, source number 14. Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak, and in the interest of time as well as clarity, I'm going to work with the English here, but you see the original as well. Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak says there are three types of children based on capacity. When the child reaches the age at which the child will reject a nut and accept a stone, okay, what does that indicate? Right, not capable. Child doesn't understand anything. Right, the nut, which is clearly food, toy, whatever, the child says, I don't want it. Shiny rock, oh, cool, that I want. So, such a child has no capacity, and one who takes from his property is like one taking from the trash. Meaning to say, he doesn't own anything. There's no concept of ownership. If that child is holding something, it isn't his. That's the first stage, because there's no capacity. Second stage.
Why would it be trash
instead? Correct, it's ownerless. Because the child has no ability to become an owner of anything. He doesn't understand anything.
But it may belong to somebody before he picked it up.
Then it belongs to whoever it was before.
I understand, so why does it automatically determine what it says?
Right, so the assumption that we're dealing with here is that the child picked up something from the street that the owner had given up hope of, and there is no prior ownership to worry about. Therefore, if you take it from him, technically, you've done nothing wrong. If he accepts a nut and he rejects a stone, then stealing from him is theft to keep the peace, by which we mean, biblically, he still hasn't acquired anything. Even though he shows the ability to decide what's good and what's not good, biblically, he has not acquired anything. Rabbinically, we're going to say he acquires. And the reason is in order to keep the peace. Because if you're going to take from children at that age, you're going to start a fight, taking candy from a baby, so to speak. In the previous case, we said you were allowed to take the candy from the baby. In this case, we're saying, no, you may not take the candy from the baby. Because we don't want you to, we don't want people running around taking things away from children. That's the second category. And then you have the third category. If he keeps nuts and stones and stores them for use later, so he shows the ability to understand that things have uses at different times. And sometimes the nut is important, and sometimes the stone is important. And he's going to keep it until it's ready for use. Once a child reaches that age, stealing from him is complete theft. That child has now reached full maturity. You follow? This is what we call, in the Gemara's terminology elsewhere, Yodea Betiv Masa Umatan, understanding the nature of commerce. When a child reaches the point of comprehending that different things have different values in different situations, and is able to determine this is going to be good in this situation, this is going to be good in that situation, now you're talking. And now, his transactions are complete. So that's the idea here. In source number 15, you get a slightly different formulation of it from Rava, but the similar idea. That there are three types of minor, he has different differentiations, but he says if the child rejects stones and keeps nuts, then he can acquire. I'm not going into Rava in depth here. I just wanted to show you. The first source was from the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud. The second source that I bring here is from the Babylonian Talmud. What these sources say is that capacity is what matters. Once the child shows, we didn't give any age distinctions, right? Once the child shows an understanding, at that point, whatever he acquires is his. The problem that we have is source 16. Because source 16 says, no, age is what matters. If a minor finds something and you take it from him, that's called theft to keep the peace. Meaning, because we don't want people stealing, but really, biblically, this minor had no ability to acquire the item that he found. Rabbi Yossi disagrees. We're not going to address Rabbi Yossi, but he has an alternative view. So my problem is this. Sources 14 and 15 said that I don't care how old the child is. Pre-capacity, the child does not acquire. Sort of capacity, the child acquires rabbinically, is at least protected rabbinically. Once the child has full capacity, then it's his. Source 16 tells me, no. Anything that a minor finds is not really his, but rabbinically we're going to protect him. It's all about how old, not about the not about the child's capacity at all.
The purpose of 14 is that the kid could be 15, and if he doesn't understand things, it doesn't matter.
That's correct, because we'll end up just calling him a shote. Well, an adult who doesn't understand is simply incompetent. Right. There's more to be said about that in terms of whether a default presumption is when you deal with an adult versus a default assumption when you're dealing with, let's say, a 10-year-old. But that's a separate point. So, how do I resolve the tension between sources that say I care about capacity and sources that say I care about age? So, if you turn to your third sheet, you will find how we deal with this. Two different approaches. The first approach is the approach taken by Rabbi Moshe Isserles in the Shulchan Aruch, which I brought you in source number 17. Rabbi Moshe Isserles says that the difference between the two sources depends upon what your case is. You know what? Before you see source 17, take a look back again at source 16 and tell me, how did the minor get the property? Found it. In sources 14 and 15, how did the minor get the property? How do you know?
It says, to reject something, you need to be given.
So you're assuming that the case that we're giving as the barometer of his maturity is the case in which that's the item that I took from him. It doesn't have to be so, right? There could be, this is a child who has reached the age where he would, if given, we still could be talking about a found item. However, Rabbi Isserles says, that's the distinction. He says, sources 14 and 15 that say it's about capacity are talking about a gift. Source number 16, which says explicitly it's an item that he found, let's talk about something he found. And so Rama in 17 says, Katan shenosnim lo tsror vizurko, egoz vinot lo. A minor who rejects stones and keeps nuts, zochalatmo, is able to acquire, and then in parentheses, vidavka kisheyesh das acheres makne lo. Specifically, where another person assigns it to him. Abel b'mitzia lo, but not where he finds an object. In other words, Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, suggests that if someone else is giving something to him, and this goes back to the point that you made in the source, right, about Hiknahu, where it's something he's giving to somebody else, where something is being given to the child by somebody else, Then we are going to say what we said in source number 14, source number 15, even as a minor, the child will acquire it once he has capacity. And if he has full capacity, then he acquires it biblically. If he has sort of capacity, he acquires it rabbinically. However, if the minor finds something, no one gave it to him, the only intellect involved in the transaction is that of the child, then we're going to say, as long as you're a child, you're only protected rabbinically. You have to be an adult in order to actually acquire something fully on your own without someone giving it to you, without someone assigning it to you. That's the distinction he makes. If you take a look at the bottom of your sheet, I made a table for this, hoping that that would help make it more clear. I gave you there, you see, four columns of opinions. The modern view is that whether you were acquiring a gift or something called hefker, something that you just picked up out of an ownerless area. Hefker is a term we use for something that it has no owner. So whether it's a gift or something you're acquiring from the street, doesn't matter. Modern times, no age, no capacity, it's yours. Roman rule, again, no distinction between the two types of cases. You have to be 7 years old, and there is no capacity test. Just be 7 years old, and it's yours. The Ramah, Rabbi Yisraelis, says it depends. If it's a gift, someone else assigned it to you, then you don't need to be of a particular age. You just need to demonstrate capacity. If it's hefker, something that you're picking up, then biblically it's not yours until such point as you reach some minimal level. I wrote 6 years here for the Ramah. I'm actually looking at it and thinking it could even be 12, 13. I'm not sure of that. But you also will require capacity, right? Whereas, if it's, you know, rabbinically, it's even at any age, and even without capacity, you'll be protected because we don't want people going around taking things. That's the Ramah's explanation. But what I found particularly fascinating, and to me, if you get nothing else out of the shiur, get this, this I found particularly striking, is the idea of the shach. Well, that was strong. No, get everything from the shiur. But the shach, Rav Shabsai Cohen, commenting on the Shulchan Aruch, on the code of Jewish law, proposes a different idea. He says it depends on the child's age. The resolution of 14, 15, 16 of those sources depends on the child's age. He says you can't distinguish between gift and found item because the Talmud did not make any such explicit distinction. When it discussed cases, we did not find the distinction between where someone else is giving it to him versus where he's finding it. So he says, don't give me that sort of a distinction. It's true a transaction is stronger if somebody else assigns something to you because someone else is saying it should be yours instead of just you saying it yourself. He recognizes that, but he says, I don't care. That's not the distinction going on here. Rather, he says, the statement that taking a minor's found object is prohibited in order to keep the peace is regarding the youngest class of minor, meaning someone who's below the age of 6. If the child is not of any age, the child is an infant, and the child has no capacity, then the child is rabbinically protected. Then the child is rabbinically protected. In the event that the child is already 6 years old and of capacity, then the child has biblical status to be able to acquire. And that's the difference between the sources. 14 and 15 that said that the child is able to acquire at the age of capacity, that's talking about where the that's talking about the biblical situation. Source number 16, which says that a minor is protected, that's rabbinic. That's the idea. So what he's suggesting is that a minor, once he reaches the age of 6, so long as he has capacity, is going to be able to acquire things biblically. This flies in the face of everything we've seen. To do a quick review of what we've seen, we said that a minor does not have ability to engage in contracts in Jewish law, either because he's not really a person, or because instrumentally it's a bad idea. From a utilitarian perspective, he's going to make mistakes, he's going to get himself into trouble. So we said minors can't do that. That's number one. Number two, we got to the discussion of when a child is able to give or sell to others and said minors shouldn't be able to give things away. Minors should not be able to sell things to others. The only thing we'll do is give him some latitude rabbinically to be able to do so because we want him to be able to survive. Right? That's the idea. So how can you come here and tell me that when it comes to receiving a gift, the Shach says, Once a child has demonstrated capacity, this minor is able to acquire things. Where did he invent that idea? We just said minors have no status. They're not people. Where did the minor get this ability? So I read an article by Rabbi Hanoch Goldberg, who is a rabbi as well as lawyer in Israel, in which he floated a fascinating idea, which I'm going to quote outside of the text, but the text for it is source number 19. Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, deals with a completely different issue. There is a set of actions that one can perform to seal a transaction in Jewish law. These are called kinyanim. One type is, something enters your yard, you close the gate, it's now yours. The item is yours. Another is, you pick something up, demonstrates that it's yours. You lead an animal along, that shows that it's yours. In certain cases, you give someone money. Right? All sorts of ways to acquire something. They're based on biblical verses in which that type of transaction takes place. They're all based on the Gemara at the beginning of Kiddushin tells me which verse they come from. Depending on the context in the biblical verse, we will know whether they apply for Jews only or also for Jews and non-Jews, depending on the context in which it takes place in the Torah. So, David, your camera just beeped. I don't know if that means anything. I'm guessing it does.
That's a question in the back.
All right. So what we're saying is that the only way a transaction can be a method of transaction is recognized as valid is if it comes from biblical verses. That's the core idea. The Chasam Sofer, though, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, in source number 19, floats the following idea. He says the rules that certain transactions work for Jews and not for non-Jews, or have to be done in a particular way based on biblical context, only applies to methods of transaction that the Torah itself innovated, that in society as a whole would never have been recognized. So he gives you an example of Kinyan Meshicha. If I move an item from here to here, I acquired it. He says, from a secular perspective, no one would have viewed that as an act of acquisition. It's a novelty that the Torah innovates. And because of that, you have to follow the guidelines that the Torah gives for that innovation to work. It only works in this context, not in another context. However, says Chasam Sofer, let's say you're talking about something that, the case that he specifically gives here is, where was it? You bring an item into your home. You paid for an item, you bring it into your house. He says any random human being on earth would recognize that as now being yours. You paid for something, someone handed it to you, you brought it home, obviously it's yours. I don't need the Torah's restrictions on where that's going to take place or not take place. It's very clear, it works everywhere. In other words, there is a bedrock form of transaction that's just human, that isn't legislated by the Torah. That's the Chasam Sofer's idea. So this fellow, Rabbi Hanoch Goldberg, wants to suggest that the same thing is true when it comes to acquiring something, when it comes to the minor requiring something. That the reason why the Shach is willing to say that biblically a child acquires something that the child picks up at the age of 6, even though we've said over and over again that the Torah doesn't recognize the minor and doesn't recognize a minor's transaction, is because picking something up, not simply moving it from point A to point B. Meshicha doesn't imply necessarily picking it up. It's just dragging it from point A to point B. But picking something up in your hand and taking it home, he says, that's universal. And therefore, it will apply, even without the Torah recognizing the child as an ish, it'll be recognized as a valid form of transaction of the child. That's what he floats as the idea. So what we're saying is, minors do not have standing in Torah law. As in terms of transactions. We say that whether for utilitarian reasons, whether because they're not a person, so to speak, the minor doesn't have standing. That was number one. Number two is the minor therefore cannot give away things, cannot sell things to others either. Although we make an exception, Mishum Kidei Chayav, for the sake of the child's survival, which we give very broad latitude for, except for notable exceptions, like if he's going to use his abilities to violate Torah law, then we're not going to recognize it. Or in the event that he's going to try to get involved with the land, we're not going to recognize it. But in general, we give the child that latitude, rabbinically. Biblically, the child has no standing. But when it comes to receiving something, receiving a gift, picking something up and making it his own, Then we have a debate as to how this works. It is clear that at some point it works. Looking at the table that I gave you on the sheet, the position of Rabbi Moshe Isserles is that if it's a gift, the child acquires it at any age, as soon as the child has capacity to demonstrate understanding of what items are and what their value is. If he picks it up on his own out of the trash, then rabbinically he's protected again at any age, even without capacity. The position of the shach, the last position that we see though, says no. Biblically, the child acquires it at the age of 6 with capacity, because what he's done is something that anybody would recognize as acquisition. Picking something up automatically makes it his, and then rabbinically he'll be protected at any age. That's the position taken by the shach. I have a couple of questions of my own regarding this, but I think we've gone far enough with it. But I have some questions about Rabbi Goldberg's thesis and about how to deal with certain issues in the Ramah. But I think we've gone as far as we should go with it. Next week, God willing, borrowing without permission, and we'll deal with a number of cases. I hope that are popular cases. The sitter that you find in shul, are you allowed to pick it up and use it? It's one favorite one.